Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. Alberta scientists are benefiting from the experience of British researchers who first dealt with the outbreak of mad cow disease 20 years ago. Dr. Danny Matthews is one of those British researchers, and he was in Calgary recently at a prion symposium to talk about his early experiences. And while fishermen may hate cormorants, these big black birds are not to blame for the collapse of the walleye fishery in Lac La Biche. Andrea McGregor is a biologist studying cormorants and the role they play in the lake's changing ecosystem. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The emergence of mad cow disease in Britain in the mid-1980s took everyone by surprise. 20 years later, scientists are still at a loss to explain the exact mechanism that makes prion proteins misfold and become diseased. The unfortunate fact is that mad cow disease and other related forms such as scrapie in sheep, variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans, and chronic wasting disease in deer and elk are continuing to spread around the world. And there is no treatment for any person or animal that contracts these spongy brain diseases. Dr. Danny Matthews was involved in some of the early investigations into the mad cow epidemic in the United Kingdom. Today, he is the Transmissible Spongiform Encephalopathy Program Manager, looking after research and surveillance at the Veterinary Laboratories Agency just outside of London. He's also a member of the Alberta Prion Research Institute's Scientific Advisory Council. Danny was in Calgary recently at a prion symposium and gave this insight into the early research on mad cow disease.
Well, what we sometimes forget is that science has moved on quite a lot since those days, so we simply had to make use of the tools that we had available. And the first things we had to try and prove was that the disease we were dealing with was a transmissible disease, that it could be transmitted particularly to mice and to cattle experimentally, and that it wasn't just the result of a toxin or a poison that had got into feed and that was generating a neurological disease. Once we knew that it was infectious, then we clearly were dealing with something that was going to have a much longer lifespan than a toxic event would have, where you might have one batch of feed that was contaminated and then subsequently it would be eliminated. But also it indicated that with a toxic issue, for example, you might have been dealing with a contamination that took place weeks or months earlier, whereas we've ended up with something where there's a history of at least 5 years, usually, with the majority of cattle between the point when they become infected and when you see it as a clinical disease, which makes it very difficult to study.
You were talking about dose response and the early days trying to figure out how much would cause an infection. How did you actually find out how much was necessary to cause an infection?
Well, at the end of the day, it's a relatively crude and simple experiment. Inevitably, you have to infect animals experimentally, and in this case, we did it with cattle. You gather together a group of calves, and usually about 4 months of age, we have them ready for infection by mouth. So we gave them doses as high as 300 grams, which was split into three doses, down to 1 gram for the first study. And then we sat back and waited to see whether they developed BSE and died of BSE. Then we examined the brains and confirmed that they were infected. And that first study took us, I think it was 110 months before we eventually terminated it. And there were about five animals that remained alive that were clearly not infected. But because we hadn't reached an end point in that sort of study, you like to get a group of animals where none of them die. And that enables you to quantify the minimum infectious dose. So it meant we had to have another study. We had to include a group that had a high enough dose that we knew would infect it. So we had a small group with 1 gram. But we subsequently infected groups of 15 animals to doses as low as 1 milligram. What you do is tenfold dilution of your starting material. So we go from 1 gram to a tenth of a gram, a hundredth of a gram, to a thousandth of a gram. And you sit back and wait and see whether they die.
So it really doesn't take very much, does it?
It certainly doesn't take very much in the context of your ability to police feed bans, for example. It's a very small amount and very difficult to prevent that sort of level of exposure, either being introduced into a country or transmitted from farm to farm. But we have to also remember that BSC does not transmit easily. You get the impression that 1 milligram infects an animal, but it must be easy. But 14 out of the 15 still remain healthy 95 months after they were exposed. So the probability of infection is very low at those sort of doses. But occasionally one animal will become infected. And the real problem is if that animal ever survives to maturity, where it's close to clinical disease, and it dies, it gets killed, and its brain is then rendered and recycled into meat and bone meal, then that represents a big pot of infectivity to potentially contaminate more batches of feed.
Now, you said in your talk that even though we have feed bans in place, feed is actually still a very important means of transmission. Why is that?
Well, primarily because of the low dose, coupled with importation methods, routes of importation by boat through ports which handle other raw materials, and the handling of materials in feed mills, for example, can't always prevent small-scale cross-contamination. So, for example, one of the problems we had in the UK up until 1996 was that we allowed the skull of cattle still to be rendered, but we were allowed to take the brain out of that skull. The brain was seen as dangerous, the skull was not, so you could render that skull, convert it into meat and bone meal, and put it into pig feed. But it was going into feed plants that were also producing cattle feed. And with hindsight, we realized that the small amounts of brain material still remained in that skull after you've taken the brain out. And that would have been sufficient to contaminate the meat and bone meal that was used when you processed the skull. So the real worry is that may be perpetuated by just small amount of accidental cross-contamination in the feed plant.
Do you have a problem with the feed plants not really keeping things very clean?
It's not entirely an issue of keeping things clean. The industry that we're dealing with simply cannot prevent that small-scale cross-contamination, and that's why we took the measures in 1996 simply to exclude meat and bone meal from the feed mill in its entirety, because we realized they couldn't actually prevent it. We had similar problems with cross-contamination with antibiotics, for example. Now, in some countries, they've gone to the lengths of separating the manufacture of feed for cattle and sheep from feed for pigs and poultry, so they could still use meat and bone meal in the pig and poultry feed. But that's the only way they could guarantee that the cattle and sheep feed did not become accidentally contaminated. But it really depends on the scale of your industry and its distribution before you could decide to take those sort of draconian measures.
We're seeing these prion-related diseases popping up in more and more animals. You mentioned goats, for example, in France. What's the problem there, and are we going to be able to bring an end to this?
Bringing an end to it in cattle is probably a lot easier than it is in the other species. The problem we have with sheep and goats is that there is evidence that with scrapie they can transmit from animal to animal. So it remains to be seen that if they do get BSC, whether they have been capable of naturally transmitting it to other animals. Whether or not they become infected really depends on the extent to which they actually consume contaminated meat and bone meal. So there is an issue there about how much meat and bone meal was naturally used in sheep feed, for example. It was a rare event in Britain, so we believe that they didn't get heavily exposed to BSE. But in a country where they produce a lot of milk from goats or from sheep to produce cheese or milk, then they would have been more intensively reared and received compound feed. So there could well have been meat and bone meal in that. So that has the potential to trigger an epidemic. But having said that, we've got to take into account the amount of surveillance that's now being done in Europe, which does use some molecular discriminatory tools looking for BSC in these populations, and it's proving very difficult to find. So it could well be that either those populations didn't actually become significantly infected with BSC, or if they did, that it hasn't survived to subsequent generations, because those exposures would have been 20 years ago.
Can we at this point actually deactivate the prion-infected material?
Well, it depends on which context you're really talking about here. there are clearly some methods of reducing infectivity. Proving it's gone to zero is very difficult. So, for example, for feed production, one would be needing to use rendering systems that were at high temperature and pressure, where there's been evidence that you can, to all intents and purposes, inactivate. The problem we have in Europe is that because of the political and economic pressures, we haven't yet got to a point where we feel we can rely on the rendering system to make the meat and bone meal safe. So we've got both high temperature and pressure rendering plus feed bans still in place. With time, there might be pressure to start pulling back some of the controls. And whether we will ever be confident enough to rely just on the rendering system, I don't know. It could well be that we'll end up with a system which totally excludes brain and spinal cord, for example, and then trust the rendering system. But there are other studies that have been taking place into inactivation, looking more at whether you can inactivate it in the laboratory and make the laboratory safe, make your experiments safe from cross-contamination, or whether you can make surgery safe for humans. If, for example, surgical instruments were used to operate on a CJD patient, could they be made safe so that they didn't transmit to the next patient when those instruments were used on them? So there's a lot of work gone into that area, and it does look promising, as if we may be able to deactivate or sterilize, shall we say, surgical instruments so that they can be used safely and not have to be destroyed.
You were asked to address some of the gaps in terms of our knowledge about these prion-related diseases. What is it that we still need to address? What are the important questions?
Well, the big unknown is still, what is the agent? We tend to refer to prion almost as if, in common language, it actually means something. But the bottom line is that it still relates to what is thought to be an infectious protein. But where there is still some occasional conflicting data, and to me, that is the key finding for all of these prion diseases, humans and animals. Can we actually identify what causes that disease? How it can be transmitted from animal to animal will be better understood if we can do that. And there is evidence, for example, that they are not universally transmissible from animal to animal or human to human. And understanding the makeup of the agent would actually help you understand that, why it happens, why it doesn't happen, and how you could then control it.
What would you say are the risks to consumers today?
Risks to consumers from BSE are extremely low. They always have been. The evidence in the UK is that potentially 3 million cattle were infected with BSE. The majority of those would have been killed and consumed, while many would have been consumed as prime beef when brain and spinal cord were not heavily infected. A large proportion would have been mature cows where the brain would have been heavily exposed or heavily infectious. And in the early days, before we introduced our initial SRM ban, then that material would have been going into the food chain. And quite clearly, the number of infected people in the UK does not suggest that BSE was easily transmissible to humans from cattle. You then have to take into account the amount of infectivity that exists in certain tissues and which tissues we actually can consume. So we primarily consume beef, muscle. And at the moment, the evidence is that if there is any infectivity in bovine muscle, it is at undetectable amounts at the moment, and the sort of amounts that really cannot represent a risk to a consumer. The jury is out about whether it exists there at all, and maybe we'll get to a point where the diagnostic tests are so sensitive we will find it in trace amounts. But I still believe that the key risk to consumers has to be brain and spinal cord, and that the primary protective measure would be to take that out of the food chain.
What can Albertans learn from the UK experience?
Wow, I think they've already learned a great deal. And in fact, the response of the public to the findings that you had with the cases in Alberta from 2003 suggests that they've been relatively relaxed about the risks. I think they have to bear in mind that just because beef is produced in a particular country doesn't automatically make it safe. There may be some BSE-related risk associated with it, but it depends on what protective measures your governments have put in place. In reality, I'm pretty confident that the number of BSE-infected animals in North America, Canada and the USA is pretty small when you compare it what happened in Europe. So therefore, as long as you're taking out some of these high-risk tissues from the food chain, the risk to consumers here or in other countries that import your beef has to be extremely low, and much lower than the majority of other risks that they run from day to day.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Danny Matthews, the TSC program manager at the Veterinary Laboratories Agency in the United Kingdom. He's also a member of the Alberta Prion Research Institute's Scientific Advisory Council, and he was in Calgary recently speaking at a Prion symposium sponsored by Alberta Ingenuity and the Alberta Prion Research Institute. Something people are seeing more of these days at Lac La Biche in northern Alberta are big black birds called cormorants. Just 30 years ago, cormorants were considered an endangered species, but they've come back in big numbers. Now, you'd think people would be happy about that, but unfortunately, many are not. Because cormorants eat fish, many anglers blame the birds for ruining the walleye stocks in Lac La Biche. But biologists say that's not the case at all. Andrea McGregor is a graduate student of Dr. Lee Foote at the University of Alberta, and she's studying cormorants and what role they play in the Lac La Biche ecosystem.
Well, my interest in cormorants actually started 3 years ago when I started working on cormorants in Lac La Biche, and I've learned so much about cormorants and some of the issues related to cormorants all throughout North America, as well as the issues in Europe, that they've become really fascinating to me, and being able to cross the boundary between being strictly wildlife-related and fisheries-related is really interesting to me.
What is a cormorant? What's it look like? What's it do?
A cormorant is a fantastic black bird. It's related to pelicans. It's in the Pelicaniform family, and it's a water bird. It's not quite as big as a goose, probably about a 2-kilogram bird. It's one of the only inland species of cormorant in North America, but there's about 36 species of cormorant in the world. It's a fantastic little bird.
I understand that anglers don't really like cormorants.
No, anglers have been opposed to cormorants for a really long time because they're a fish-eating bird, and there's been some perceived competition over fish resources between cormorants and anglers.
What's the real situation from an ecology point of view?
Well, what we've discovered in Lac La Biche, looking at some of the historical records and what we see with the cormorant population now, is that humans actually over-harvested our sport fish populations in the 1920s, 1930s, back in, you know, the late 1800s. We were already worried about over-harvesting a fish population. So we remove walleye, remove pike from the system. And when we remove these top predators, we allow all these little fish to become really abundant. Like when we cut down the big trees in the forest and all of the little saplings can now thrive in the system. And so what happened then is we removed all these predators and we had little species like yellow perch and cisco that became incredibly abundant in the system. And cormorants can take advantage of that food source.
So cormorants are actually getting a bad rap as far as the walleye fishery is concerned.
Absolutely. There were very few walleye in the system by the time cormorants came back in large numbers. If walleye were in the system still, they would probably offer direct competition for cormorants for food source resources.
What's your research focusing on then?
My research is actually looking at the impact of cormorants on some of these fish species, primarily yellow perch in Lac La Biche, as well as modeling the Lac La Biche ecosystem so we can start looking at some of the potential impacts of altering cormorant numbers, altering the numbers of forage fish in the system, or trying to get walleye back into the system, and how the interaction of these three key features will allow us to return the system to one that's dominated by fish predators versus bird predators.
How are you actually doing that?
Well, the main part of my project is a model that's going to be using a program developed out of UBC Fisheries Center. It's a bioenergetics-based model that includes all of the different trophic levels in the system and kind of looks at how energy flows in the system. And what I'm hoping to look at is how this energy flow is different with cormorants as top predators and walleye as top predators, and which of those, you know, the cormorants, the forage fish, and the walleye is really driving the system, and how we can alter the system to flip it back to a system being driven by walleye. But a lot of that is related to some of the fish work that I'm doing. We've created a model that kind of estimates the impact of cormorants on the fish, or how many fish cormorants are taking in the system, but because we don't know what the system is capable of producing as far as yellow perch. We don't really know what impact the cormorants are having, and we're hoping some of my work will help us determine what this impact is.
What would be a balanced system?
A balanced system, that's very society-driven. If we want to go back to, pre-angler, we don't really know what the system was like then, but in the late 1800s, we had a system where, walleye were dominant, pike were present in large numbers. We had some big perch, but not a lot of them, enough to sustain the system. We had big white fish, we had some cisco present, and we had some cormorants present in the system. So if we can get back to a system where cormorants are there in reasonable numbers, but walleye are actually, and pike is another top predator, are controlling what's happening in that system, that'd be ideally what we want to get back to.
What is it now? How many cormorants are there?
Well, in 2005, we had just over 8,000 nesting pairs, so 16,000 adult cormorants within a 45-kilometer radius of Lac La Biche. And about almost two young birds per nest fledged from that area.
That's absolutely incredible when you think that they were endangered at one point and not that long ago.
Absolutely, yeah. In 1970, they were listed as an endangered species. And in about 1980, their numbers all across North America started to increase. And in Lac La Biche, we've estimated about 11% per year since then.
With them being so successful now, is that a problem at all for the birds or any other species that are in the system?
Well, as far as the birds, we're not quite sure what their carrying capacity is going to be. So far, their numbers are increasing. They're not increasing at as great a rate as they were in the past couple of years. But so far, they seem to be holding their own, and there's still lots of habitat for them, and there are other lakes that they could move into and exploit. With respect to other species, it's kind of a double-edged sword. Because of the alteration in the fish community, that's probably helping support some of the other bird communities like western grebes and pelicans. Pelicans will feed directly, harass cormorants and feed directly from them. But there's also some concern, especially in eastern Canada, over the impact of cormorants on nesting habitat and competition with other co-nesting species such as great blue herons and black-crowned night herons.
Now, you mentioned that these fish communities have really changed, and now it's more smaller fish, the forage fish. Could you explain that to me? How is it that the system goes towards small fish as opposed to bigger fish?
What happens, we have three main effects within the system that are kind of driving what happens with the fish. So first of all, we have walleye in our system, and they have these what we call cultivation effects. So walleye are doing whatever they can to maintain their reproductive capacity and make sure that their babies are growing to be adults. And as a result, they're eating some of the forage fish that would otherwise, compete directly with their babies or predate on their babies. When we remove these top predators out of the system, we remove this cultivation effect and we get a second effect called compensatory mechanisms. And what that means is like when you cut down the big trees in a forest, all those little trees are allowed, they can use all of the nutrients and the sunlight and they're allowed to thrive. So that's what happens. We remove the walleye from the system, we get compensation in the little fish and they become incredibly abundant. They can spread out throughout the lake because they no longer are being controlled by these big fish. And that's where we see the change in the cormorants, with cormorants as the top predator. What we think is happening a little bit with cormorants is that they don't have the same type of cultivation effect that walleye would have. So cormorants were attracted to the system because there are all these forage fish, but they come in and they're keeping the fish small. They prefer to eat fish about 15 centimeters in length. So they're taking fish about this size, and it may be causing some evolution in the fish, specifically the yellow perch. So they're maturing earlier, and they're smaller at maturity. So what we have now is a system that's full of little fish. And we've got young of the year fish, and we've got little, 5-centimeter fish and 10-centimeter fish. And the cormorants, we think, they're cultivating this fish community to keep all these little ones available to feed their babies. Whereas the walleye would be feeding on the little yellow perch because those are the ones that would be feeding directly on their young and they want to increase the survival of their young.
It's amazing because it sounds like there's actually a purpose behind what's happening here.
Well, and that's hopefully what we're trying to show, It all comes back to, or what we think it comes back to, is this flip in systems. So one of the things I'm really looking into is the application of this theory called alternate stable state theory to the Lac-La-Biche ecosystem. And what that's basically implying is that the system was stable in a state with walleye as the top predator, and all of these changes have happened, both in the water quality and all the stuff going, you know, going on underneath the water and the overharvest, and it's reduced the stability of that system with the walleye as the top predator. And when we removed the top predator and allowed these forage fish to become abundant, the system kind of flipped, where into a system where walleye can no longer come back on their own, and cormorants are thriving in this system. So we now have a cormorant-dominated system, which isn't really appealing to most of the public. And that's why there's this new drive to flip the system back to one where cormorants are still present, but walleye are now dominating the system. So we have these alternate states that Lac-La-Biche can exist in.
What would you like to see come out of this?
I would like to see, A, if we can do it. I'd like to be able to show that that Lac-La-Biche can exist in this system, and let hopefully get people to realize that a lot of our human impacts on the system are what's causing these incredible changes, and that we don't recognize initially the impact that these changes are going to have directly on society, and that we need to be more careful in some of the things we do and act more on an ecosystem level and look at entire systems versus just focusing on walleye or just focusing on, you know, specific species that are important to us, because we need to maintain the health of an entire system, because it makes it so much harder to get back when we realize what we've done wrong.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That was Andrea McGregor, a graduate student in renewable resources at the University of Alberta. Her research is sponsored in part by the Alberta Conservation Association. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Ingenuity, the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Research Council, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Calgary Technologies, Inc., the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Innovation and Science, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.